When we did that, those cattle, once they received the tothromycin metaphylaxis, they were eligible to get pulled and enrolled in the treatment site after 4 days. We ended up seeing, again, a pretty substantial health challenge. Both those groups, both the tothromycin and enterofloxacin first treatment groups, we ended up repulling 50% of those. And so, again, it was really in the dead of a tough winter. And so, which is, again, higher than expected when we did the power calculation. We set that for 70, detecting differences between a 70 and 60% repull rate. And we saw 50% in both groups, but no difference, no statistical difference within those groups.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lallemand Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm Travis Molinix, and today I have Dr. Shane Terrell with me. Welcome to the show, Shane.
Thanks, Ev. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
So, Shane, you're a veterinary consultant with the and research director with the Production Animal Consultation Group there in Nebraska. I knew y'all covered a lot of feedlots and a lot of cattle, but I did not realize you guys probably cover about 30% of cattle on feed as part of your group.
That's right. No, and so we got a group of 11 or 12 veterinarians that are covering feedlots, mostly in the Great Plains regions, in the Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, but kind of from the Midwest to the Pacific Northwest. There's a group of three of us that are involved on the research side. So I've got Dr. Jacob Hagemeyer and Dr. Aaron Jobman that work with me on the research side, but I'm still primarily a practitioner. Those two are full-time on the research side, and then I spend time in feed yards and helping coordinate the research efforts.
That's great. That's tremendous. So you got your DVM, a master's in biomedical science, a PhD in pathobiology from K-State, a lot of interest in bovine respiratory disease, which we'll get into, lameness detection technology, antimicrobial resistance, and have published in different journals of bovine practitioner, etc. So we've done a lot of experience, see a lot of feedlots, see a lot of cattle on feed. So we'll have a really great conversation of animal health. Anything you want to touch on your background that I didn't cover?
No, just, I live in central Nebraska with my wife, Kelly, and our kids. And I guess she's involved with her family's feedlot operation here in Gothenburg. My family are producers in northwest Nebraska on kind of around cow-calf yearling background or operation. And so besides for the great clients that we get to deal with on a daily basis, we get to touch production agriculture on the other side, and particularly Kelly's involved with it on a day-to-day basis. So.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac's new Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. These four vaccines deliver quality protection against respiratory and reproductive diseases in the vaccine combinations you need to protect cattle at every life stage. Bovagen Platinum Vaccines are comprehensive and safe, have consistent supply made in the United States, and are backed by a 6-month guarantee in the Bovagen Platinum Protection Program. Start your platinum protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection or contact your Virbac representative.
And we won't touch on it, but you come from a very unique background of what's your family's operation there in northwest Nebraska, and some unique situations of actually running some sheep for a while that was a unique opportunity that you don't hear stories like that of how that happened, but very cool operation, good example of how to get into the cow-calf operation or for a family that didn't own land. But today's topic, we're going to talk about a study that compared two different treatments of bovine respiratory disease after in the feedlot after following a metaphylaxis. And so kind of for the audience, kind of give this background of the study itself, what the two treatments were and what you're looking at with it.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's a, you know, it's a fairly conventional treatment study as far as comparing two different products, but really it was the idea and the drive behind it was as we have moved to a new economic plane as far as the antibiotics go, the macrolides, so specifically tillithromycin, gamithromycin, tilmycosin, tilpidrosin, those are getting utilized more frequently, whether it's in the feed yard or prior to the feed yard, and as those have become more affordable. And in the meantime, obviously cattle prices are at record highs, and the value of these things are remarkably high. And the capital investment, specifically in the feed yard sector, is it's really substantial. So when we're looking at filling every 10,000 head of capacity right now is a $30 million capital investment, and so. So it's significant, and so utilizing all the tools we can is important, but making sure that we do it as appropriately as we can and do it in a judicious manner is of equal importance. So that's really the driver behind this study, because we're looking at specifically looking at tillithromycin metaphylaxis. And so those, I guess, that aren't familiar with metaphylaxis, it's the use of antibiotic at initial processing to mitigate existing BRD and shipping fever to mitigate the morbidity rates within a group of cattle, and so those macrolides are using they represent a pretty large share of the market share of metaphylactic antibiotic use due to their nature of their pharmacodynamics and long duration antibiotics.
So where did this study take place? I mean, you think about regionality of the feeding industry is, we've got, the Texas Panhandle. And then we get into the Midwest and Nebraska, Kansas, and the type of cattle getting into those feedlots are totally different. And so you have more, a lot of high risk calves coming in through the Texas Panhandle that may went through wheat pasture, et cetera, in Oklahoma. And then you get in the Midwest, you typically get, a lot of calves that are not necessarily high risk, but still have some disease issues or some respiratory issues that will pop up.
Yeah. So, for a treatment study like this, we tend to go after a higher risk population, just with the dynamics of research to detect differences. The higher level of the disease, the easier to detect differences in these products. So this was done in the Northern Plains, but the sources of these cattle were a lot of commingled sale barn, Missouri, Arkansas type cattle, and so a fair amount of risk in these cattle, and these were placed over beginning late fall, early winter, and these treatments would have primarily been pulled right in the dead of winter, and we definitely saw that in our outcomes. We had a pretty high health risk due to this would have been conducted in the fall of 23, spring of 24. And I don't know if anybody remembers the long duration cold breaks that we had in February 2024, but this would have been right in the middle of that. So we got a really good health challenge, which from the research standpoint is good.
from the feeding standpoint, that's not great. But
yeah, absolutely.
So there's that conflict of interest that you want that data. It's good data, but from a feeding standpoint, your feeders, it's not ideal for them either.
Yep. Yeah. No. That's definitely the balance we want to find a population that's a normal population for that feed yard, and that we're not asking them to go out and find tougher cattle than they're wanting to handle, for sure.
So what did this study find comparing those two treatments on the health aspects of these calves and performance outcomes?
Yep. So when we looked at there, when we did this study, we at enrollment, we enrolled over 3,000 head of cattle that were eligible for enrollment. So cattle that received the tulothermycin at initial processing. And so when those received the tulothermycin initial processing, then they're eligible for enrollment. Those cattle were then randomized when they showed up at the hospital within that their specific lot. And so if an animal was pulled from pen 20, lot 110 per se, those animals within that pen would be randomized to one of two treatments, either a subsequent tulothermycin treatment, and so the same antibiotic that was used at initial processing, or with enterofloxacin as an alternative, and really, again, with the goal being to better understand subsequent macrolide followed by macrolide, or specifically tulothermycin followed by tulothermycin use, because that's happening in the industry, and I guess we wanted to go out and see if we could get a better understanding of what the impact of that is. So we enrolled those over several months. They were, I guess there's 35 lots of cattle, I guess, in those 3,000 plus head that were eligible for enrollment. We enrolled 483 in the study into each of those groups. Treatment studies are always hard to do a power calculation on. If we're using mortality as the clinical outcome, your study's got to be as big as as you can possibly imagine, and not financially feasible. And so usually when we do those power calculations, we're looking at retreatment rates. And so that's what we used on our power calculation. But like I said, the nature of these treatment studies is they're hard to power appropriately, but this is one of the larger ones that you'll see. It's pretty standard to see 500 head treatment studies, I guess, within the research community. So when we did that, those cattle, once they received the tulothermycin metaphylaxis, they were eligible to get pulled and enrolled in the treatment site after 4 days. We ended up seeing, again, a pretty substantial health challenge. Both those groups, both the tulothermycin and enterofloxacin first treatment groups, we ended up repolling 50% of those. And so, again, it was really in the dead of a tough winter. And so, which is, again, higher than expected when we did the power calculation. We set that for 70, detecting differences between a 70 and 60% repull rate, and we saw 50% in both groups, but no statistical difference within those groups. Again, with the health challenges there, we saw higher case fatality rates. So case fatality rate is more or less the mortality rate on those treated cattle, and so when we saw case fatality rates in each of those groups around 20%, which is rough, probably double what our expectation would be for this population. But again, in the middle of a really tough winter and some high health challenges, for every 100 head that we treated, we ended up losing about 20, and there's no difference between those groups. And so, so again, from the research standpoint and power calculation standpoint, that's because we had those higher rates, our ability to detect differences was higher, and we still saw no difference in those groups.
Was there any difference in average daily gain or some kind of performance outcome that could help tease apart some of that? Because you're right, is a yes or no response is very tough sometimes, you know?
Yeah, so we did. We looked at average daily gain, hot carcass weight, all the carcass parameters. We didn't see any difference in hot carcass marbling, average daily gain, performance outcomes on those. All those cattle were given an EID at treatment, and so we tracked those via EID. The only difference we did see statistically, there's a slight difference in back fat. We suspect that's a type 2 error, just a false positive with all the other change, or I guess all the other parameters being the same. But we just need that, or you know, to see probably subsequent research on you know to make sure that that's. That comes through, I guess, after subsequent.
So in the current market, antibiotic market, why was this study such an important thing for you guys to look at? You know, you kind of touched on it a little bit.
So yeah, definitely. I mean, looking at judicious use and of antibiotics, we want to really ensure the long lasting usefulness of the tools that we have. And this study it was sponsored by Virbac. They have both of these drugs in their portfolio, and it was important to them also. But for us, we knowing that the macrolides and specifically tothromycin is getting used a lot more, we wanted to make sure we made the best choice as far as retreatment on those cattle, and with that, not knowing the history of these cattle prior to if they've received tothromycin, or we suspect they've received tothromycin, is that going to affect our outcomes if without knowing we use tothromycin followed by tothromycin. So one of the things we did in this study, which is unique, and again, it's hard to power it economically correctly, but we did take deep nasal pharyngeal swabs at initial processing on six of these 35 lots, and then resampled subsequent pulls, first, second, and third pull on those cattle. We pooled those when we could. So on arrival, we pooled 5 head within each of those lots to do the susceptibility and resistance testing on those, and then when we got within those lots, multiple animals pulled within the same week, they're pooled. When they weren't pooled, we ran them individually. We didn't see any, I guess, as far as the trends go on that, we didn't see any differences in resistance profiles at first or second or third treatment between tothromycin and enterofloxacin. We did see an increase in resistance, a trend towards increase in resistance in general between subsequent treatments, which is to be suspected as we put air in the face of each of those antibiotics. But on arrival, in general, we saw susceptibility to tothromycin and enterofloxacin on those cattle on arrival. So I think it's the maybe just the start of understanding that better, and hopefully it's one piece of literature in a large portfolio of antimicrobial resistance studies and over time as we continue to do, and as an industry we continue to do more and more of these comparisons, but without these differences in tothromycin and enterofloxacin, I think it's important. I don't think this doesn't tell us that we aren't causing increased resistance to telithromycin, or both in the outcomes front or in the antimicrobial resistance front. It's just the start of a catalog of hopefully multiple trials that we can better answer those questions. And I think it's important as an industry to better understand that.
I think, you know, and that's important because, you know, a lot of research is stair-stepped of this is the first block to that stair-step of understanding that, not saying that you have a final answer of this is, you know, they're more resistant or less resistant. It just provides a little more evidence going forward of what is the recommendation that we're not getting these resistance occurring.
Absolutely. And within the industry, there's we've done some other work that we've got published that looking at antimicrobial resistance at first treatment over more cattle than this and looking at subsequent resistance and treatment outcomes. And BRD is a multifactorial, multi-bug disease. And so it's very complex. And certainly in human and medicine, there's a direct path on a lot of, you know, say a urinary tract infection or something that when we're able to culture in human medicine, when they're able to culture that and do resistance susceptibility testing, there's a difference in outcome between resistant and susceptible organisms on a multifactorial disease like BRD, where we're dealing with Menheimia, Pasteurella, Histophilus, you know, multiple viruses. It's not as a direct line, And so there's a lot of work to be done to better understand that those differences if there is differences in outcomes to clinical susceptibility and resistance testing. And again, the paper I referenced earlier, I'm not going to stand up and say that there isn't a line between resistance and clinical outcome differences, but that was 400 plus head that adds to the evidence, I guess, and we didn't see it in that 400 plus head, but there needs to be a lot of numbers there over time to really understand that.
Yeah, definitely is a start to that.
Yeah.
So what is your recommendation to feedlots now of after knowing this? You know, are you changing any recommendations? Are you keeping your recommendations the same?
I think this is the first step to establishing more data on macrolide to macrolide use. I think it's something to have in the back of our mind. It's available evidence. It's certainly industry standard, or has been industry practice to at least change those antibiotic classes between subsequent treatment. But I think the questions that continue or in my mind is, okay, that we didn't see it when we looked over it, those first polls over long periods of time. Can we see differences, you know, 2 weeks after metaphylaxis versus, you know, 4 weeks after metaphylaxis? Is there a time period there where we can go back to, you know, to a macrolide or telithromycin after metaphylaxis, a duration effect? And I think that's probably the research that I'd be interested out of this is, you know, okay, when we look at it, you know, first polls being any time between, you know, day one and 50 days till ship, we didn't see when we spread that out over time, we didn't see any difference. If we could really power that up, if we could see what's it look like day 7 to 14 after metaphylaxis, day 14 to 21. So as all research, it's great. It's good data. Always maybe leads to more questions but that's how we fine tune and get there.
So. You know, you're bringing in these mixed lots and you're seeing not necessarily resistance, but that there potentially is there like a genetic tie that could be causing some of this, or even a regionality of where these animals are coming from and how they're managed prior to coming into that receiving lot.
Yeah, we certainly know that how long it takes to build a lot affects morbidity and mortality. So if we're, you know, it's just the nature of the beef industry. If we didn't have to commingle any animals ever would be ideal, but that's going to happen. How fast do we build those pens? I think we know that the, you know, when we can when we build those faster and not string that over time, we're going to have better health outcomes. And, you know, and the challenge of this study, again, it showed the effects of weather and those outcomes. And so when we get significantly cold time periods, you know, going back to my partner and mentor, Dr. Tom Nofsinger, it's, you know, health is a triad. And maybe the most important part of that is the immune system of that animal, and a lot of those components are husbandry, and that's, you know, that's thermodynamics, that's hydration status, and all those things. And so when you get into significant weather challenges, and this yard did a nice job trying to address them as best as it could, but when you get in those extreme weather scenarios, that host response is important.
You can only do your best you can in those scenarios of, you know, we've got to work within the challenges that are presented to us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Shane, is there anything we missed that you want to touch on?
No, I just give a shout out to Virbac for sponsoring the study. They weren't comparing their product versus somebody else's. They were trying to answer an industry question, which I appreciate. And then I guess as far as that goes, again, mention Dr. Aaron Jobman and Dr. Jacob Hegemeyer that work with me on the research team, and they did a lot of work on this. And so I wanted to mention them again.
Yeah, these large production studies that are done in the industry are so important. You know, from academia, we tend to do, you know, smaller lot studies. Data resources, but these larger, especially dealing with vaccination sickness, et cetera, and lots are, you know, very important for advancing our knowledge on the animal health side.
No, absolutely. And that's, I mean, there's, you know, there's tiers of evidence, and there's nothing better than large population clinical studies, but you know, on the same side, we're thankful for the academic studies that push their, you know, we can't economically do a lot of the things that you guys do on a small scale, on a large scale. So it certainly drives us in the direction we need to be looking.
It's time for our famous three.
Well, Shane, to wrap us up, I've got three questions here. The first one is what is your go-to highly recommended beef resource that you recommend a beef producer to utilize?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I'm on the road a lot, and so I'm listening to a lot of podcasts. I'm listening to a lot of audiobooks, you know, and that's how I get a lot of mine. So I love some of the podcasts out there as far as ability to get information easily. And but I would say probably the biggest thing is for me as far as resources is utilizing whether it's academic extension, you know, or other continuing ed opportunities. There's a ton of great resources out there, those can truly be operation changing. You know, you don't have to, every meeting you go to is not going to change your operation, but establishing those principles and understanding those things over time, there's definitely days that certainly change the trajectory of a production operation.
Very important is, I don't know if a lot of producers understand the amount of information and help that extension, your vet clinics can provide you in dealing with some of those challenges. And so there's a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, we're all stressed time-wise. We don't, you know, it's hard to take an evening or take a day away from getting more work done. It's important.
It's very important. Second is, what is a book, could be non-ag book, that you highly recommend someone reading?
Well, that, and again, that's a really good question. I had a good friend that he handed me the Daily Stoic by Ryan Holiday, and that's led me into some of the Stoic philosophy, and so The Obstacle in the Way is the Way by Ryan Holiday is probably one of the more impactful ones I've read in the last few years, and all of his books are good, but I certainly appreciate the change in mindset that provides.
So that is a book that I have given out. I have recommended to every student that's graduating is The Obstacle is the Way.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So many times, you know, we think of these obstacles as challenges, problems, but you know, they are opportunities, and that book is a great for mindset of obstacles.
Yeah, that's great. You're handing them out to students. That's, anytime you learn something, you wish you'd known it 15 years ago or 20 years ago. What a great resource for a 23, 24 year old walking out the door, probably.
So lastly, in your opinion, what sets apart a successful beef professional from someone that isn't?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to my first response, but I think having a willingness to challenge yourself on a consistent basis, and whether that's going out to, again, continue education and have some people challenge your perceptions. Certainly within the veterinary medicine community, it's been really it's always good to get around not just my partners and our practice, but and sharpen your recommendations around them, but also industry meetings and being just around other veterinarians is big. And I think from my perspective on the producer side, I think you can see the producers that are out there challenging each other, and you can see the ones that maybe aren't, and it makes a big difference.
That's tremendous, and appreciate the answer, because so many times we get stuck in our ruts of this is how we've always done it, or this is accepted dogma that doesn't necessarily always hold true, right?
You know, and I'll tell anybody, my favorite clients are not the ones that do everything I recommend, and it's not the ones that do nothing I recommend, but it's the ones when I make a recommendation, they challenge me on it because they understand their resources better than I understand them. And, you know, and a blanket recommendation isn't going to be the same for everybody. And so whether it's me as a veterinarian or other producers doing the same thing, you know, what works for one person isn't going to work for everybody, but unless you challenge each other to go through that process of why this does work or doesn't work, and really, you really understand, you get a better understanding of the resources you have in your lab once you challenge yourself with those questions.
And vice versa, because part of your job is challenging them too, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And so they may not take your advice, and they have the freedom to do whatever they want to do, but it's part of your job is to challenge some of that and provide them other avenues. And so it's, they have to make up their own mind in that decision, but... And so that's the beauty of it, is that not only do you learn from them, you know, they're taken away from you.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Shane, thanks for jumping on the podcast and having you on here. Great resource. Your group is a tremendous resource to a lot of beef producers, not only the feedlot side, but cow-calf as well. And just a plug, you guys have a tremendous magazine that gets sent out to people to read. A lot of great resources there as well.
Sure. Yeah. And you, I guess if anybody has any interest, our website's PACDVMS.com. And you sure read up more about us. But yeah, a great group to work with, and really thankful to be colleagues with all of them.
Great. Well, thanks again, Shane.
All right. Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent with Appa Time Zone Hassle. delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.